Department of Corrections say the drug is effective, but opponents counter the sedative is painful. The sudden change is baffling to Brian Kammer.
It's a strange situation, and I don't know what the rationale is behind doing it at this very odd time.
Kammer is the attorney for 52-year-old Warren Lee Hill Jr., a man on death row. Hill is mentally disabled. A U.S. Supreme Court ruling bans the execution of the mentally disabled. Georgia is the only state that requires proof of, quote, mental retardation beyond a reasonable doubt. A motion has been filed with the U.S. Supreme Court for a stay of execution. For NPR News, I'm Rose Scott in Atlanta.
Dow up 85, NASDAQ gaining 35. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from LifeLock, committed to protecting its members against identity theft. Details at 1-800-LIFELOCK.
Join us in September for WILL's Civil War Train. Board vintage train cars for stops in Vicksburg, Atlanta, Kennesaw Mountain, Chickamauga, and New Orleans. Visit the Smithsonian Southern and Southeast Railway Museums and see Civil War-era Washington, D.C. The trip is nearly sold out. Call 217-333-7300 or visit www.will.illinois.edu/willtravel for more information.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
Historian James Barrett says America's first ethnic group, its first immigrants, were the Irish. As such, they laid the foundation for the immigrants who followed. That foundation was at once hostile and welcoming. Hostile as it could mirror the greeting the Irish received upon arriving here. Welcoming as it could be an acknowledgement that the experience of poverty, hunger, and injustice was something to leave behind. Barrett says in the end it led to a new sense of American identity that continues to shape us today as the most recent immigrants strive to make a life here. James Barrett tells the story in his new book, The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments this morning. I look forward to your contributions. Join the discussion with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And the email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. James Barrett is a professor of history at the University of Illinois. The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City is the newest volume in the Penguin History of American Life series. James Barrett, good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
So what can we learn about America's immigrant experience, its entire immigrant experience, from the experience of the Irish?
I think one reason that they're important in that broader context is this idea that they were in some sense the first ethnic group in the United States. And since there's a lot of other people involved here, I just wanted to explain very quickly what I meant by that. They appear as a distinct group, partly for reasons of accent and language and so forth. It's a very cohesive group, if only by default. In other words, you mentioned in your introduction, they faced quite a bit of discrimination themselves and sort of closed ranks and developed institutions that would help them get by. They developed an identity coming from a very local kind of identity, kinship, village, that sort of thing. They developed first a broader identity as Irish, and then eventually an identity as American or Irish-American. And I think that that kind of a process is a process, regardless of all the differences between the ethnic groups in the United States, that pretty much all groups went through. They usually faced some discrimination in the early stages and developed institutions within their community that allowed them to get by. This issue of identity is also very interesting because not just the Irish, but most immigrant groups that came to the United States came not with a national identity, but rather with kind of local identities. And one of the ironies is that they develop their national identity in the context of the United States after they get here to American cities. And that, in a way, provides an avenue for them forward to eventually developing this broader identity as Americans.
So let me see if I'm understanding this correctly. So you have a kind of a, you come here with kind of your hometown feel, your village, your small group back home. You come into a larger setting, in this case, the city. And so you develop a sense of an identity of being Irish. And then from there, with time, you become an American.
Right. I think that developing that broader identity as Irish, in a way, actually helps them to get by. The Catholic Church, for example, was not an institution that was peculiar to any particular group of immigrants coming from Ireland. It was one that was shared by people from a lot of different areas of Ireland. And you can go down the list. If you're going to develop effective political organizations in the city, you're going to have to do that on the basis of a broader sort of identity. If you're going to organize trade unions, which is another thing that they did, they need to be able to identify with one another across local lines of division. It's interesting, though, that you still see, in spite of what I just described, especially in the early stages, you'll see sort of pockets of people from particular areas. So on the docks in New York, you know, people tended to come from Clare, and paper handlers in a certain part of the city, freight handlers might come from a particular area. On the police and the fire department, depending on who was in superior positions and in those institutions, it could help you if you came from one county or another. But that's something that sort of dissipates over a period of time. And in any case, in the meantime, they develop enough of a broader identity to be able to organize across those kinds of local lines.
Yeah, I'm thinking now of one of the things that comes to mind in thinking of the Irish experience in America is sort of at once taking part in the American experience, but yet being quite parochial.
Right. The parochialism could actually lead to problems. First of all, the term which people use kind of generically in this case is quite apt because a lot of their identity, the organization that they accomplished tended to be on a parish basis, and the parish was also the most important institution in their lives. And that sounds mostly good. It makes for a strong religious life and makes the parish a center for other kinds of activities, social activities and so forth. But it could also lead to kind of a closed quality of Irish communities. And as the newer groups begin to come in, you know, possibly the best example is with the African-American migrants, but you could also talk about more recent immigrants, Italians, Russian, East European Jews. Sometimes that kind of close parochial identity that they developed within their neighborhoods could also exclude. And that happened in the workplace, and sometimes it happened on city streets, and it even happened within the Catholic Church, I would say. And that's part of what this story is about.
Yeah. Well, thinking of the Catholic Church in terms of how parochial it can be, you could have an Italian parish, you could have an Irish parish, and so on and so forth. But eventually that kind of smoothed itself out. How did that happen?
Yeah. In the early stages of immigration, so far as the other groups are concerned, what tended to happen was the development of national parishes, which is what you were just describing there, where a lot of the work might be in the vernacular and everybody in the parish was more or less from the same ethnic group. That was different for the Irish. They settled into what were termed territorial parishes. And those parishes were intended for English speakers. In practice, what it meant in a multi-ethnic city is that those parishes were disproportionately Irish. And over a period of time, partly through upward social mobility, partly through physical mobility, in other words, other immigrant groups moving out of the old enclaves into more ethnically mixed neighborhoods, parishes became more diverse. There's another whole story within the story of the church, which is not very well developed yet by historians, which is the church as a instrument of Americanization. And the Irish, for good or for ill, were very much involved in that. So what I mean is it tended to be Irish priests in parishes. It tended to be Irish nuns and teaching institutions and orphanages and so forth that often introduced newer immigrant groups to American urban society. And in the process, there's an Irish mark that's sort of left on urban culture and urban society. The argument is never that the Irish are the only group to have an impact on urban society. These cultures that I'm describing are very much multi-ethnic cultures. But I think there's a case to be made for the importance of the Irish in the integration of later groups, the, for want of a better term, the sort of Americanization of later groups and the creation of this new culture. They're not the only people taking part in that, but they seem to have an important role.
Yeah, also, maybe you can talk about this same kind of thing in terms of the labor movement.
Right. I started out as a labor historian, and part of my interest in this story came from continually running up against Irish-American organizers and labor leaders. And that part of the story has some of these negative dimensions. Labor radicals in the United States sometimes referred to the American trade unions as job trusts. And what they meant was that the older, more skilled workers, the more settled workers were controlling jobs in the United States through their networks. And there's absolutely no doubt at all that you see a lot of that on the part of the Irish. They get here early. They develop some of the earlier trade unions. They get into stronger positions within the unions. And to some degree, they keep people out of jobs. The New York docks are a good place to see that, but you could also see it in terms of some employment in Chicago and other large cities. But the part of the story that I thought was maybe not developed well enough was the more progressive side of this story, which was the effort on the part of some Irish labor activists, Irish-American labor activists, to introduce newer groups to the labor movement, to integrate them into existing unions, to organize new unions. And I think that as you kind of poke around in the labor history, you find more and more of this. So for me, in terms of the, once again, the overall kind of argument in the book, this is another case where the Irish played an important role in what we might term Americanization, except in this case it's kind of Americanization from the bottom up. In other words, it's the acculturation of new immigrant people and black migrants and other groups within distinctly kind of working class settings. This is different than the kind of Americanization that we usually think of in settlement houses and at the hands of the government and middle-class institutions. This is a kind of Americanization that takes place in workplaces, out on the street, through unions, political organizations, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I want to take a call here in just a moment, and we're going to do that promptly. But first, what I want to do is reintroduce the program and our guest. This is Focus, and this morning we're talking with historian James Barrett about his latest book, The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a telephone call or by email. We look forward to hearing from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. This is a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello, thank you very much for this program. It's fascinating to me. I have a few questions and a comment. I was wondering if you've studied intergenerational immigration. My family is on the third generation of Irish immigrants to this country and how that may be played out in history. And then the fact that there was some reverse immigration where immigrants came here and for various reasons went back home or went to England or Ireland. And then I didn't know if you were aware of the Irish American Heritage Center in Chicago that had been built by Irish tradesmen and laborers and is now maintained by Irish American volunteers. Just an interesting building that was an old school building, Catholic school building that laid vacant, and they bought it, and the tradesmen went in. There's an Irish pub. They have rooms for banquets. They hold classes that teach Irish step dancing and some historical information, that type of thing. And I'm perfectly willing just to now listen.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. And that listener is going to listen at home.
Great. First of all, on this question of studying the community in terms of an intergenerational kind of dynamic, it's probably understandable that a lot of the Irish-American history that's been written, the focus on immigration has been on the famine generation and the community in the immediate wake of the famine. And just to remind people, the period that we're talking about there is roughly 1845 to 1852. These are the, you know, truly impoverished immigrants that are, you might say, driven out of Ireland by starvation and economic dislocation. I'm interested in them, and they show up a bit in the story, but I'm actually more interested in the people that you're talking about, which is the, that is to say, the second and third generation Irish-Americans, and also something that you mentioned in passing, later immigrants. People sometimes seem to forget that immigration from Ireland continued heavily through the late 19th century, but even into the early 20th century. And the reason that I was interested in that is that these are the people to whom you're referring, are the people that were shaped not so much by the Irish countryside, but by the streets of the American city and the problems that they faced there and the institutions that they created and so forth. That was the story that I was interested in capturing. And so, if anything, the story probably focuses a bit more on Irish Americans as distinct from immigrants, and a bit more also on later immigrants, people that it was another big wave in the 1880s. And as I say, there were still many people coming in the early 20th century. And it was the city story that I was especially interested in. That's a great question that you're asking about the intergenerational dynamic here. And we could certainly talk much more about it. It's a factor in all immigrant communities, and it's very important in the Irish community. Secondly, you asked about reverse immigration, and my wild guess here is that you might have connections with more recent.
This is Focus. I'm going to reintroduce our guest while he turns off his phone. It's a hazard of life today in the talk show business. James Barrett is our guest this morning here on Focus. He's a historian here at the University of Illinois. His latest book, The Irish Way: Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City. Reverse immigration, Jim.
So it was there's a rookie's mistake there. Sorry about that. The question of reverse immigration, what I'm starting to say is if you've got any connections with more recent Irish immigrants, that's a very logical question. There's some going back and forth that's happened more recently. But this book focuses mainly on the period after the famine in the late 19th century and then up maybe to the Great Depression, the World War II period. What's interesting about the Irish in that period is no reverse immigration, just about none at all. That's especially true of the famine immigrants, but it also seems to be true of the immigrants in the late 19th and the early 20th century. So that's an interesting question of why. And at the risk of grossly oversimplifying, and I hope not slandering a country that I admire a lot, there's not a lot for people to go back to. The economy is very weak throughout most of the 20th century. People will know that there's been a real burst of economic activity and growth in Ireland over the past generation, but that was very unusual up to that point. Ireland was a place that people left. Now it's actually getting immigration, fairly large-scale immigration. There has been recently, and that just was not true at all. So reverse immigration in the broader context of immigration history, which is one of the things that we have in mind this morning along with the Irish, is very, very common. It's high among Poles and Italians and many other groups. I wouldn't say it's non-existent among the Irish, but it's very, very low. And as I say, why is an interesting question. I can answer quickly on your question about the Irish American Heritage Center in Chicago. I know of it. It's as far as I can tell, it's a wonderful institution. not just for the Irish community, but also for introducing other people to Irish history and culture and so forth. It's amazing how much they've accomplished there. I have to admit, in all honesty, that I don't know the institution personally. I'm waiting very patiently for an invitation from the Irish American Heritage Center to go and talk about the Irish Way, but it has not arrived yet. So if I don't get that invitation pretty soon, I'll just go down and have a beer.
Okay, very good. This is Focus. This morning we're talking with historian James Barrett about the Irish Way, becoming American in the multi-ethnic city. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a telephone call or by email. Let's take another call now. This is a listener on line one in Bement. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Jen. This is Bill Grell. I was just wondering if you've ever been to Ivesdale, and if there, I know you're talking mainly about cities, but if there are other like small towns that were at least at one time almost entirely Irish.
Hi, Bill. Yeah, it's a that's a good question because actually for a number of different reasons, and I'll try to stifle my enthusiasm here. First of all, the people in Ivesdale, and you know, of course, it's not just Ivesdale. I mean, there are other, there are some other communities like that, are the exception that proves the rule. By 1920, about 90% of the Irish American population was urban. So they're, you know, really, we could talk about a lot of different characteristics of the Irish, but probably above all, they're urban people. And mostly what we mean by that is large cities, at least in the case of the Irish. However, there's some people that they're spread out quite a bit. They're spread out within cities and they're spread out across the country to a considerable degree. And there are some people that you'll find in rural communities. And although I don't claim to be very knowledgeable about Ivesdale, the explanation, as I understand it, for why those people are there also tells a lot about the Irish. They may wind up doing some farming. In fact, I'm sure some of the people in Ivesdale did. That's also very uncharacteristic of the Irish, and they didn't get there to farm. It looks like the reason that those people wound up where they did was the reason they usually wound up where they did, which had to do with jobs, and particularly with unskilled kind of laboring jobs. And I think the Irish in that area were doing two kinds of work. One was laying tiles to drain fields. As everybody around here knows, you know, the water table's fairly high in the Urbana area, and those people that wanted to farm needed to drain those fields to some extent. And then the second reason was laying and maintaining track for the Illinois Central that came through right through that area. So they come for that kind of work, and then what's different from a lot of other areas is that a certain number of them managed to stay. And a part of the story here that we're talking about in the cities, but also in a place like Ivesdale, is that they begin to develop these strong institutions and sort of networks that serve them to, you know, find work, get loans, trade with other people and so forth. And as those networks begin to develop, then you get the development of strong communities. And Ivesdale was certainly an example of that.
Well, I got another question, too. Yeah, I'm a laborer, and a lot of construction jobs people will call short-handled flat shovels, paddy shovels. And I was wondering if that was somehow related to the Irish who, you know, or sometimes they use the name paddy, and, you know, them being hod carriers and using short-handled flat shovels a lot.
Right. They go into construction early, and they don't go into skilled trades. They go into the trade that you're talking about, which is laboring jobs. And this was a case where one of the reasons that they come to predominate is to some extent they drive people out, other people out of those jobs. We mentioned that earlier on. In the 19th century, there's a lot of black laborers and some other ethnic groups that are doing that kind of work. But the Irish move in very quickly and take over a disproportionate number of those jobs. They come into the cities in eras of tremendous expansion and building, not just building construction, but also the subways and sewer lines and so forth. It's, you know, in shorthand, what's happening is that the United States is urbanizing. And in shorthand, what's happening is that the Irish, along with other groups, but disproportionately Irish laborers, are creating the sort of infrastructure. So I have to be honest, I have not heard of paddy shovels before, but I've heard of all kinds of other paddy objects, and usually what they're named for is the Irish immigrants that first took them up in large numbers.
Well, if you saw the crew that I'm on right now, you will probably be thinking that we'll change the name of the shovel to the Pedro shovel.
Yep. Well, things
things happening right now.
Yeah, the labor market has changed a lot, and that's actually part of the story here. You know, new people coming into the labor market. Thanks, Bill.
I want to thank you for your call, and we're going to take another call here momentarily. But I think I want to get to this question. Okay, so there's work in the cities, for a lot of folks, maybe there are people they know who are there already. However, I have to think it has to be really tough to make a transition, no matter how bad rural life was in Ireland, to city life.
Right. So part of the discrimination that we were talking about earlier is based on religion. And some of it is based simply on the fact that they're immigrants coming into American society. All this is kind of the mid to late 19th century that I'm talking about. And they're taking jobs that Americans, quote unquote, might otherwise be able to take. But another part of the discrimination has to do with slums. And the Irish moved into generally in the mid to late 19th century, they moved into a lot of the worst housing in the city. And I think it would have to be said that, in turn, they did not necessarily improve the housing. And some of that has to do with the background that Celeste just asked about. These are among the most rural people in Europe. In other words, if you look at urbanization in Europe in the 19th century, you're not going to find the Irish. They're living in rural areas. So they come from those rural sort of agricultural areas, and they come into densely populated cities. The housing that they're in is grossly overcrowded, mostly for reasons of poverty. They're not used to living in the city, and the communities are well recognized as slum communities. So I don't think it was easy at all. I don't think in the short run it was easy getting work, and I don't think it was easy living in the city. And some of the problems that we associate even today, social problems related to issues of poverty certainly characterize these early Irish communities.
Let's take another call now. This is a listener in Urbana on line 2. Good morning.
Oh, this is Bridget again. The paddy terms interested me, and I was wondering if you were familiar with a term called narrowback. It's one that my brother that was born here in this country was called all the time we were growing up. And I finally figured out what it was.
Good.
It was really difficult. And what it is a lot of Irish did bricklaying. They were hod carriers, and you had to have a broad back in order to be able to do that type of labor. And usually it was your first generation Irish that did those kinds of work, and everybody else tried to work their way up. And so someone that was born in this country, irregardless of what the size of their back was, were called narrow backs because they weren't born in Ireland.
Okay, well, I'm learning some things this morning, and I had heard that phrase, but I didn't know I didn't know the origins of it. And one thing that I wanted to point out there is that at least in the early stages, they're the hod carriers. They're not the bricklayers. So
that's correct.
Right. They're doing the laboring work. And then eventually, you know, you get Irish skilled Irish tradesmen, but it takes a little while for that to happen. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And that makes me think of something you talk about in the book, in the chapter you call The Stage Culture. This listener reminds me of the tension between wanting to succeed, you know, becoming established in the States, and yet remembering one's roots. So narrowback is kind of on the one hand, it's an acknowledgement of moving ahead. On the other hand, it's an insult, right?
Yeah. I was tempted to say, as Bridget was talking, that it does sound like kind of a pejorative term. And this happens within the community. The most visible sort of distinction of the sort that we're talking about is between shanty Irish, sort of poorer Irish on the one hand, and so-called lace curtain on the other hand. And what's interesting about that latter term is that, as far as we can tell, I stand to be corrected on this, but as far as we can tell, it came into common usage in the late 19th century and didn't seem to exist before that, and probably was not an Irish term, probably was an Irish-American term. And what's interesting about that is that the upward social mobility in the community is slow. It comes, but especially for men, it tends to be rather slow. And so you don't really have much of an Irish-American middle class before about the late 19th century period. But more and more then, as people become more educated, as businesses are established, as professionals begin to emerge in the community, you get a distinctive Irish-American middle class. And this question that Celeste was asking, which to me seems to be broadly reflected in all different sorts of popular culture, music, plays, even later in films, is a kind of almost guilt about moving up in the world, the Irish would say rising in the world, and a great affection and affinity for the old neighborhood and the old gangs and so forth. And even as people begin to move up in the social structure and become more acceptable and more respectable, there's always, on the one hand, a fear, a kind of anxiety that that respectability can always be lost. And I'd have to say I think there's good reason for that anxiety. People are kind of looking over their shoulder because of persistent anti-Catholicism and discrimination to some extent against the Irish. But looking the other way, there's a kind of anxiety over the rising itself, and you know this strong sort of affinity for the old community that they had created in the city. I think it's a good question, and I find it all over the place in early.
I think
Irish
it's interesting
society.
That you don't want to put on airs. I remember Calvin Trillin talking about his father in his book Messages from My Father. His father's term for lace curtain would have been a big knocker, Mr. Trelinsky.
Yeah. The term in Chicago often, rather than lace curtain, is steam heat Irish. And again, it's kind of pejorative. It's not a compliment. It's the idea is that these people are really no better than the poor people in the community, even though they've moved up. And if anything, there's a bit of resentment about that. All they've got that's different is steam heat rather than coal.
Mm. This is Focus from Illinois Public Media. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn, our technical director, Jason Croft, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. This morning, we're talking about the Irish experience in America. Our guest is James Barrett. He is the author of The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City. It's the newest volume in the Penguin History of American Life series. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free 800-222-9455, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. I wanted to go back to the labor movement, Jim, because I think that's really fascinating and so important. As I was reading this portion of the book, I was thinking of the John Sayles film, Mate One, where we have workers coming together, Italians, African-Americans, and they're pitted against one another, and ultimately they come together and say, you know, we're better off pulling together despite our differences than if we go off on our own. And I thought it was interesting in the book, The Irish Way, that you write about the Teamsters and street strikes in Chicago, where people occasionally, from time to time, I don't know how often it happened, but they would join together for the greater good.
Right. The Teamsters are kind of a nice case precisely because they're practicing their trade out in the streets, and they're going through the length and breadth of the city. So when you have a problem with them, it tends to be spread throughout the city, and the real problem areas were the real problem areas for people trying to continue to convey things in the city by wagon were the densely populated immigrant neighborhoods. And these are moments when this narrow kind of parochial approach that the Irish take sometimes expand. The perspective sort of expands a bit. And it expands for obvious reasons. If you take the case of the Teamsters, that was a disproportionately Irish union. And incidentally, we're talking about the early 20th century here, so everybody should forget about the trucks and be picturing carts with wagons. But over a period of time, newer groups come in. So by the time of this particular conflict that you were asking about in 1905, there are a lot of Polish Teamsters, and there's also a substantial number of black Teamsters. And the strike, on the one hand, united these groups. The Teamsters actually tended to be very good in terms of coming in to help other groups of workers, a lot of sympathy strikes on their part. But the 1905 Teamster strike is also a place where you see the limits of this kind of broader identity on the part of wage earners, in this case in a city like Chicago. And the limits particularly tend to come in the form of race. And in this case, what happened is that even though you have a substantial number of union black Teamsters who take part in the strike, who support the strike, they're attacked along with other African Americans on the street and, African American strike breakers. The reason that this is significant to a historian is that we're interested in where this racial animosity and where race prejudice comes from. Too often in the United States today, even, and historically for sure, it's talked about as something almost like the weather. Kind of a natural development. You know, people are different colors, and so they're not going to like one another. There's not actually a lot of evidence for that. To the contrary, it seems to be a historical problem, and it merges for understandable reasons. And what's important about this particular question that you ask is that in the case of the United States, because the different ethnic groups are often pitted against one another, and one ethnic group is brought in as strike breakers in a strike, this did happen sometimes with African Americans. That tends to be what really sort of stokes the racial animosity. And I have to say that it becomes something for which the Irish are famous. And this is probably not the only explanation for it, but certainly a lot of this early hostility on the part of Irish Americans towards African Americans, for example, comes from these confrontations during strikes, and the race line is drawn rather rigidly.
Before too much time goes on here, and we're running down on time so quickly, talk with us about the contributions of the women, Irish women, and they're critical players in this story. We haven't really talked about them yet.
The original plan for the book was to have a whole separate chapter on Irish American women, and I reached a very firm decision not to do that, and I think for good reason. The reason is that they're all over the place and that they're extremely important in each of these kind of spaces in the city that we're talking about, the church, the street, the workplace, the union, the stage. And there's probably a number of different explanations for this, but one of them is actually pretty straightforward, which is that the Irish immigrants were unusual in the sense that there's a very large proportion of women that come in the immigration. And that may sound strange, given the fact that other ethnic communities, of course, have a gender division. But the numbers for most other groups are disproportionately male. And in the case of the Irish, they're pretty even for a long time. And then in the late to early 20th century, I would say that there's more women coming, especially young women, than men. So part of it is a matter of numbers. One of the effects that this has, apparently, is a relatively, still not high, but a relatively higher rate of intermarriage on the part of Irish Catholic women compared with other ethnic groups. So from my point of view in this book, one of the things that does is to bring them into contact with other ethnic groups and in effect to create multi-ethnic families in the city. So that's one area. They're very important in the labor movement. They're organizing the newer immigrant women coming into workplaces. They're very important in the political sphere. This is a whole part of the story that I felt had really been left out. Irish American suffragists and Irish immigrant suffragists, women who are fighting for women's votes, and again are especially important as sort of middle, not middle men, but sort of middle women between the native-born, often elite women reformers who sort of created the suffrage, women's suffrage movement on the one hand, and the great masses of immigrant women on the other hand. It was often Irish-American women that did the stump speaking and helped to organize immigrant women behind the drive for the vote.
And they were also out in the workplace, whether it be as domestic servants or as shop girls, or what were some of the other possibilities?
There's a number of ethnic groups. Italians are a real good example where it was thought to be unseemly for married women in particular, and to some extent all women, to be working outside the home. You know, they should be in the home and protected, very patriarchal sort of view. That tended not to be the case with the Irish, partly for practical reasons, but also because of these assertive women. They're disproportionately working outside the home. The statistics on that are very good. You find them every place, but especially in the first and to some extent even in the second generation, in other words, well into the 20th century, you'll find them disproportionately concentrated among domestics as maids and cooks and so forth. And part of the interesting story here was the transition from that first generation, sort of Bridget's generation, if you will, of the immigrant cook and maid, to the second generation that the caller mentioned earlier. And the first generation of Irish domestics become famous for support for the community. Their wages are low, but their costs are also low. They're often living in the homes of elite people. They save and they pass on the savings. They're famous for supporting Irish-American organizations, Irish nationalist organizations, and they're also famous for sending their daughters and nieces to school, disproportionately high level of education among second-generation Irish-American women, higher than men. The men are sort of tending to go into skilled trades because they've got their connections there, and those are pretty good, well-paid union jobs. And the women are, very many of them are going into professional jobs, not just teaching, also nursing, social work, that sort of thing, but an enormous number of teachers, to the point that in Boston and in some other cities, there were efforts to put quotas on the number of Irish Catholic women going into, this is public school teaching I'm referring to, because there was a fear that the public schools were being, quote unquote, hibernicized.
Mm. I grew up in the city of Rockford, and speaking with folks a generation or two older than I, they faced, the Italian Americans faced the same kind of thing in the city of Rockford, where it was, there were so many Italian women probably coming out of Catholic schools with a good education and who went on to college. They faced discrimination in terms of trying to get into the school district as a teacher.
Right. And, you know, part of the fear here is these are public schools and they're not Catholic schools. And the fear sometimes on the part of school boards, for example, facing this sort of tidal wave of Irish-American women coming into the schools is the fear that public schools will, in effect, become Catholic schools because of the ideas and the sort of traditions and culture that, that they'll bring with them. Not very much evidence of that I've been able to see that that was actually happening. I think they towed the line and recognized that there's a division between church and state here and that these are properly public schools. And pretty good reputations as teachers. Whatever divisions we can point to between Irish-Americans and the other ethnic groups, the Irish-American teacher in immigrant memoir literature often has a very positive sort of reputation. They were recognized as role models and as people that helped immigrant youth make the transition to American urban society.
What allowed for the first and second generation women who were activists, who were in the suffrage movement, who were political activists, what allowed for that? And did that change as a family was in the country over a longer period of time?
I think it probably changed. One way has to do with education, which we just talked about. But the thrust of your question, I think, goes in a different direction, and the answer has to be somewhat speculative. But I think here's a case where the roots in Ireland actually do make some difference. One of the things that happened very briefly is that women were in a relatively strong position economically and in terms of their position in the family and so forth before the famine. This is, in other words, helping on small farms and being sort of important figures on these small farms. There's not a lot of small farms left in Ireland after the famine. Those are pretty much wiped out and land is consolidated. At the same time, the Catholic Church changes as an institution in Ireland in this generation of the famine, and the space for women becomes far more constricted. There's a real division between the so-called bachelor culture on the one hand and the spinster culture on the other hand. So what I'm saying is that you had a situation where women had considerable latitude and were involved in a lot of areas of life in the pre-famine period. That seems to be closing in the post-famine period. At the same time, the educational institutions in Ireland, which is one thing that they can thank the British for, the national school system established, and these young women are going through that school system and getting pretty good educations. It turns out that's a volatile mixture. In other words, they have less standing and feel sort of slighted. They have less prospects in Irish society on the one hand. On the other hand, they're relatively well-educated and they have aspirations for what they want to do. What results is this great wave of women leaving Ireland and coming to the cities of the United States. And they come with these aspirations, and sometimes they're frustrated within the first generation. These domestics often are not in a position to really take advantage of educational opportunities in the United States. But what happens then is that they make sure that their daughters and their nieces and so forth are able to take advantage of those opportunities. And it's in that sort of juncture between the first generation of women and the second generation of women that you get this growth of sort of activists and a lot of professional women, sort of a very prominent role for the Irish-American woman in American urban society.
What was the view from Rome regarding the Catholic Church in America and its Irish ways?
Right. There's a fight that takes place over that. One perspective, and interestingly, you find the Irish-American hierarchy on both sides of this fight. So there are conservative hierarchy that I would closely associate this with Rome. Argue that the church is distinctive. The church has to be separate from American society. That's the whole point, in a way. There have to be completely separate Catholic institutions. It's important to maintain these and so forth. And there are conservative Irish Catholics who support that point of view. And then there's a whole load of hierarchy and many lay people and priests who support an opposite point of view, which is that the church is now in American society, and it's partly an American institution. More than that, it can actually help immigrants make the transition to the United States. This is the sort of Americanizing role that I was referring to earlier, that the church must adapt to American urban society, and it must help its flock sort of make that transition. And because of their disproportionate numbers, their control of the hierarchy, their control of educational institutions, English language publications, and so forth, the Irish are especially important. And I would say, if only by default, it's the latter position that wins. In other words, there is an Americanized church that begins to sort of emerge, and that Americanized church has a strong sort of Irish character to it.
Hmm. How long does it take to become an immigration success story?
Well, it's a good question. I think it took the Irish a while. One of the factors is the degree of discrimination. The history of immigration in the United States tells us that all immigrants can expect a certain amount of that. The Irish came pretty early in the story, and they ran up against quite a bit of it. In part for that reason, depending a little on what you call American. I think it took a little while for them to become more respectable, for them to move into professional and upper middle-class positions and so forth. But you can view it from a different point of view, which is that precisely because they faced some of these obstacles and a certain amount of opposition to their rising, if you will, they developed very strong institutions, and one that we haven't had too much chance to talk about this morning, that gets a certain amount of attention, is the Irish American political machine, mm-hmm. the urban machine, and that's a way forward for them. And many people would say that there's nothing more American. You might not like the institution, but it certainly is a democratic institution, and it comes from the roots, from these communities, and it becomes a way for the Irish to answer your question, to become American, to generate a certain amount of political capital, a certain amount of influence. And peculiarly, at the same time, it becomes an institution that once again is a kind of bridging institution between kind of mainstream society, major political institutions on the one hand, and the immigrant poor on the other hand, because the Irish became masters at integrating the newer immigrant groups into the machine once they were forced to do so. And it's in their interest to some extent to serve those constituencies, if only to retain their votes.
Yeah, I got another big question for you, and we're here at the end. This is the last question. So what does this experience say to us about where we are today in terms of immigration? Because we're still fighting our way along here.
Right. So the story for immigrants and the kind of culture and society that we're creating as a result of a new generation of mass immigration, I would say is, if anything, much more complicated than the period that I'm talking about. I was talking about the late 19th and early 20th century. Here you're talking about a greater diversity of immigrants. You're talking about proportionally every bit the size of an immigration that we were talking about in the early 20th century. So it's certainly having an impact. But the tough part is to identify the important sort of influences within this tremendously diverse immigration that we're experiencing and its effects on creating a multi-ethnic society. So to be clear, what I'm saying is that one could argue, we'd have some disagreements, but I would argue that the Irish played a particularly important role in these early periods. It's a little bit harder to put your finger on one particular ethnic group that had a real strong influence in the last generation. Some people have argued, it's a very interesting argument, that at the level of popular culture, which was one of the things I was interested in here, that African Americans have had a great impact on newer immigrants coming in, if you think about music, performance, and so forth.
But you really can't say African Americans are immigrants.
No. I think in that case, it might be the closest thing that we have to sort of mainstream kind of native-born culture. My whole emphasis in this book has been on the mixture of these different ethnic groups and creating a multi-ethnic society.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. James Barrett is the author of The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City. It is the newest volume in the Penguin History of American Life series. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Sus.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu.
Support comes from the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, hosting the 2012 Grassroots Radio Conference, July 26th to 29th in Urbana. The conference brings together media artists, organizers, radio operators, and citizens to learn, discuss, and brainstorm. More information and registration is at grassrootsradioconference.org.
And again, a reminder that we'll be live with another program tomorrow at 10 a.m. as part of a day-long initiative examining access to healthy food in the region, with a conversation about finding food in farm country. Kimberly Cronick will be your host. She'll talk with Dave Bishop, a farmer from Prairie Earth Farm, Tara Brockman, founder and executive director of the Land Connection and steering committee member of the Edible Economy Project, and Kenneth Meter, who's president of the Crossroads Resource Center. Approximately 95% of the food we eat in Illinois comes from someplace else. The farmland in Illinois is some of the richest in the nation, and the state's economy is one of the worst. A growing number of people in central Illinois are working together to build clusters of regional food businesses to aid economic recovery and increase residents' access to fresh food. We'll explore the idea of local foods as a strategy for economic recovery in Illinois and the nation and dig into specific efforts in central Illinois. That's in the 10 o'clock hour of Focus tomorrow. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll rebroadcast a conversation from last July with Linda Watson, a cook and researcher and author of Wildly Affordable Organic. Meanwhile, this morning, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack briefed President Obama on the drought gripping the U.S. and its potential impact. Vilsack, in a press briefing going on right now, set the stage for Congress to aid livestock farmers and suggested the crop insurance programs already in place should be mostly adequate for crop producers of corn and soybeans. When asked if the biofuels mandate for ethanol would be lifted, he answered, "There is no need to go to EPA at this time. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency can, on its own or upon request, consider whether the ethanol mandate is causing enough economic harm to be lifted." Let's take a look at what's happening in the commodity markets at this hour. Kansas City wheat for September is at 889 and a quarter, down 3 3/4. December wheat at 907 and 3/4, down 4. Chicago wheat for September is at 889 and a quarter, up 4 1/4. December wheat at 901 and 3/4, up 4 1/2.